Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me in studio right now is Dr. Keith English. He is the chair of the Department of Pediatrics and Human Development at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. He's in town today to talk about vaccinations, immunizations, things that are great for our kids, definitely, and talk about where we stand on this issue. So, Dr. English, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you up here to talk? I mean, we know you're up here to talk, but what was the purpose of coming up here?
I am up here as part of Michigan State University College of Human Medicine's Your Health Lecture Series. It's a program that has faculty from MSU campuses give talks on important topics around the state. I've been up this way before a couple years ago to talk about children's health. I'm here again to talk about healthy children. This time I'm focusing more on immunization, something I did talk about previously, but wasn't the focus of my talk the last time I was up on the UP.
Now, when I was reading a little bit about your background, you received some notoriety when you were at the University of Tennessee when the H1N1 flu virus was pretty popular. Can you talk about your role then?
Well, it was a scary time. We were one of the hardest hit cities in America there in Memphis, and it was very unpredictable. Nobody knew how much worse it was going to be. You may remember that summer of 2009 that we were seeing a lot of flu, and some children died of influenza in Memphis. On a hot summer day in August, where normally, of course, there is no flu. Flu is usually a winter virus, but that year it started in the spring and was in the summer, and it was very dangerous. It was getting worse, and it was so bad at Le Bonheur Children's Hospital in Memphis, where I worked, that we actually had to put a triage tent up in the parking lot of the emergency room because there wasn't enough room in the emergency room to take care of all the children who were presenting with flu-like symptoms. And so it was a dangerous and scary time, and the role I played was really probably overstated. I worked with a lot of other doctors, nurses, community leaders, head of the schools, the mayor, to try to have a good community response. We tried to help people understand what they could do to reduce the chance they would get the flu, getting the vaccine, washing their hands, staying away from other sick people, keep from spreading the flu to other people. Don't go to work when you're sick. Don't let your children go to school when they're sick. So we tried to help, reduce the chance that it was going to get much worse. And thankfully, it did finally ebb. And even though the flu lasted until well into the winter that year, it was not as bad as we had feared it would be. So I was involved with some of the city response to the flu that year.
There are rules and laws in place to help parents make an informed decision when it comes to immunizations. So let's kind of start there and talk about what's available for parents.
Okay, well, thank you. I'd be happy to do that. I make one comment about what you said a minute ago because I think it's very important, is the reasons that we need to immunize children have to do with protecting the individual child but also protecting other children, because it's that spread through the community that's so much more likely if many children are not immunized. So it's helping your own child and helping other children at the same time when you immunize them. So that's an important point. To answer your question about the rules and the recommendations, I guess there's two sort of things. There are state laws that require immunization of children before they go to school, for example, and there are recommendations from expert groups about which children should be immunized, which vaccine should be given. So the process is very long and complicated, but when a new vaccine is being tested, it first has to go through a lot of testing, so-called preclinical testing in the test tube, in animals, etc. Once it's approved to be tested in humans, the FDA is involved with all of that. Then it has to be tested in humans and shown to be safe and effective. And then if it is shown to be safe and effective, some expert group has to say, okay, let's go ahead and start recommending that be given to children. So the process lasts a long time. There are two main expert groups, well, I guess three, that are involved with recommending a vaccine. One of them is affiliated with the CDC. It's called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP. And that group meets and reviews the information and decides whether to recommend the vaccine. And then a group that I'm a member of, although I'm not on the board that reviews the vaccines, the American Academy of Pediatrics, also reviews this, and so do the Family Medicine group. And they'll review that same information and make a recommendation about whether it should be given to all children, at what age, et cetera. The two groups almost always agree with each other. Sometimes there's a minor difference. One group will say, give it to every child. Another group will say, well, don't start until they're this age or whatever. But generally speaking, so you've got these expert groups, and those groups make recommendations to physicians in practice to say, here are the vaccines you should give the children. Those groups also now do a better job than they used to of providing good information on a website, et cetera, for parents to read about when they want to learn about vaccines. Because, unfortunately, if you're a parent and you want to learn about a vaccine and you just type the name of the vaccine into Google, Google may not be your friend. You may wind up with some alternative facts about vaccines. You may not learn much. And so there are good organizations like HealthyChildren.org. And there's actually a new organization that just went live this week in Michigan called iVaccinate.org, which is partly supported by the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Good information is available there. Good information on HealthyChildren.org, which is part of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And there are also other websites with a lot of information for parents about vaccines, like the one at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, for example. So one thing we need to do a better job of as physicians is understand that parents often go to the internet to look for information. We need to help them find good information about vaccines.
Yeah, it was just a number of years ago where, you know, rumors started going around that certain vaccines were causing autism in I think that even still persists today, where some, you know, people believe that the vaccine, you know, you go in and get your shots for school, basically get your child's shots for school, and that could lead to these other problems. And from my understanding is that was a complete myth.
Yeah, that was completely wrong. That's a really sad story in the whole history of immunizations. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't take any parental concerns about vaccines seriously. We should. And it doesn't mean that vaccines have no side effects. Like every medicine that we give, there's always the possibility of a side effect. Thank goodness, serious side effects after a vaccine are very rare. And to the autism thing in particular, there's just no evidence whatsoever that any vaccine ever caused autism in any child. This started as a sort of sad moment. The observation that people made, maybe that confused them about autism and vaccines, was that many children had their first diagnosis or their first symptoms that suggested they might have something like autism recognized when they were a toddler. And that was around the time that they were receiving vaccines. So just by chance, a parent was going to notice, you know, Johnny doesn't seem to be, you know, interacting right with us. And, you know, he had a vaccine last week. That's the way our human brains work. We try to figure out, well, why would this be happening this week? And we think, well, that happened last week. Maybe it's associated. There never was really any what we call biological plausibility that was likely to happen. In fact, we have more and more evidence today that autism is heavily genetic and that most of the brain changes that occur that lead to autism occur during brain development, during pregnancy, and young infancy. It never made any sense that vaccines might cause autism. The autism link is even worse, though, because there was a physician named Andrew Wakefield in England who proposed that vaccines might cause autism, published a paper in a medical journal, I don't know, 20 years ago, claiming that he had found the measles virus in the intestine of some children who have autism, and that therefore was the cause of autism, and it was related to the MMR vaccine. Even at the time it was published, many people read that paper and said, boy, this is a terrible paper. The evidence for this is really weak. He doesn't have the right controls. He didn't do this experiment right. What we didn't know at the time was he actually made up much of the data. It was actually fraudulent. It wasn't just bad science. It was fake science. It was fraud. And so he was disbarred, lost his license in England. He lives in Texas now. He can't practice medicine because he doesn't have a medical license. But he's never apologized or withdrawn that report. So that was a very harmful thing. Unfortunately, we are in an age where if you make an unsubstantiated allegation about something, it takes years to disprove it rather than moving on to do what we should be doing. And to me, the saddest part of this is that it distracted from research about the real causes of autism. We're not here to talk about this today, but in my department, in the College of Human Medicine, we're actually hiring investigators who study how brain development goes awry in autism. So rather than all that time that was wasted doing tons of studies that disproved this claim that autism was caused by vaccines, we should have been spending that money to study brain development and figure out why children do develop autism so we could do a better job of taking care of them.
You mentioned earlier that there may be some valid concerns that parents, you know, should consider when it comes to deciding whether or not that to immunize their children. What would those be?
Well, they should know that all vaccines have possible side effects. Luckily, most of them are what we call local side effects. There might be some swelling or redness or pain at the site of the injection. Some vaccines definitely are associated with the risk that you might develop a fever. Luckily, serious side effects are very rare. I would never say they can occur because they can occur, but a serious or life-threatening side effect is very rare on the order of, you know, millions of doses of vaccines. Whereas the common side effects are mild, they're kind of predictable. We can let parents know if there's a low-grade fever and there's some swelling there, that's okay. That's nothing to be worried about. And they always need to know that they can contact their physician or other medical provider right away if they have any questions about a vaccine side effect. We should be upfront about them. And the good news is the American Academy of Pediatrics, the CDC, and other groups do have vaccine information sheets that we distribute to parents that talk about, first of all, what's the disease that's prevented by this vaccine, because parents should know that. We shouldn't just tell them, here's what you should get. We should tell them why. And then those sheets do list the common side effects, which are mainly the things like I'm talking about, like swelling or pain, redness, fever, that sort of thing.
Is there any danger at all of contracting the disease you're being immunized for because of you're getting the vaccine?
That's an excellent question. The answer to that is usually no. Notice I said usually. For example, the flu shot that you give is a killed virus, so it's impossible that the flu shot can give you the flu. Something like the chickenpox vaccine, because it's a weakened vaccine, there would be a possibility you could get chickenpox from it if you had an immune deficiency. That's why we don't give the chickenpox vaccine to somebody with cancer who's getting chemotherapy right now. But in terms of the risk of getting chickenpox, if you're otherwise healthy, rarely some child will get two or three blisters on them, you know, instead of 500 like you have when you have chickenpox. So generally speaking, the vaccines that are killed vaccines or that are from a component of the vaccine, it's impossible for them to give you the disease. The ones that are weakened viruses like chickenpox could rarely cause chickenpox if you were immunocompromised.
Still sounds safer than the old method. When I had chickenpox as a kid, my neighbor's parents brought their children over to play because they wanted to make sure they got chickenpox at a young age so that they can overcome it and not have to worry about it when they get older.
Yeah, these chickenpox parties were pretty common, actually. And, of course, most of the time that was just fine. You did get chickenpox. And it is true, by the way, for reasons we still don't understand, that chickenpox tends to be more severe if you get it as a teenager or an adult. That's not true for many infections, right? We think of, gee, flu is worse in a young infant than in a 20-year-old. But chickenpox is different. Chickenpox is worse in adults, so it made some sense. But now that we have a vaccine, it's a lot safer than getting the disease, because the disease, while most kids got over it just fine, some of them got serious complications and some of them died. So I took care of a child once in Memphis, maybe 10 years ago, who developed a life-threatening bacterial infection. You've heard of the strep bacteria, the so-called flesh-eating bacteria.
Yes.
That can occur as a complication of chickenpox. And that child, one of his parents was a nurse, and they had decided not to give the chickenpox vaccine because of concerns they had about it. And this poor little boy almost died from not from the chickenpox itself, but from the strep infection, which involved his neck and his face. He did okay finally, thank goodness. So there were life-threatening complications of chickenpox, but boy, it's so uncommon now that many parents have never even seen chickenpox.
So other than the concern about possible side effects, is there any other health reason to not vaccinate your children?
No, not really. So the only medical indications to not vaccinate your children, there's only two types. One would be you have some kind of immune problem, so you shouldn't get that vaccine, like the chickenpox example I mentioned. And then the second reason would be if you had an allergic reaction to something in that vaccine. Now, that'd be very rare, but let's say you had this vaccine and you got what we call an anaphylactic reaction. You got hives, you got swelling of your tongue, that sort of thing. The same kind of reaction you might get, let's say, if you had a bad peanut allergy and you accidentally ate a peanut. If you had that kind of reaction, you should never get that vaccine again. So it's either a serious allergic reaction to the vaccine or something that we know is in the vaccine, or a medical contraindication because you have an immune deficiency, so you shouldn't get the vaccine. Other than that, no. Those are the only reasons. And if only those children were the ones who are not immunized, we would have, you know, we'd virtually wipe out these diseases in the United States because almost all children would be immunized, and it would be very difficult for them to spread to other children. If, you know, if one child got it, most of the children they were around would be protected, so it would never spread.
If in a, say, in a school setting, if one child has one of these particular diseases, and of course we've talked about measles and chickenpox and, mm-hmm. and the like, and I'm sure there are many others that we immunize for. If a child comes down with it, if the rest of the children are vaccinated, are they at risk or in any real sort of increased risk because somebody has the disease?
So if the other children, it depends a little bit on the germ, but let's talk about the really contagious ones. So the really, really contagious ones are measles and chickenpox and pertussis or whooping cough. Those are the ones that tend to spread rapidly to anybody else who's not protected, whereas some of the other diseases we protect against, very important, but they don't spread as dramatically as that. These spread through the air. That's why measles is so doggone contagious. It can spread. If I had measles right now, I could infect you even though we're 5 or 6 feet away from each other, whereas many infectious diseases might require close contact to spread. Measles doesn't. So if the school situation, if a child, let's say a child went to a country where measles was endemic, they're not immunized, they get measles, and they come back and they go to school here in Houghton or anywhere else. Children who've had the MMR vaccine would be protected and either would not get measles, almost all of them would not get measles, and if some of them got measles, even then they would on average be much less sick. So that's something that we don't talk enough about maybe with vaccines. Vaccines not only prevent the infection in many cases, they usually make the infection milder if you get it. So they can help in both ways. Children in the community who were not immunized against measles would have a high likelihood of developing measles if they have any kind of contact with that child with measles because it's spread by the airborne route. So, you know, they could be even, you know, cross a big room and still get measles from them. That's what makes it so dangerous. So if you've been immunized and you're exposed to somebody with that disease, you're greatly protected. The amount of protection varies because some vaccines are better than others. Even though we want every child to get it, the vaccine against pertussis or whooping cough is not as good as the vaccine against chickenpox on average. You know, but it still prevents about 90% of the cases and makes most of the cases milder if you do get the disease anyway, if you've been immunized.
Sort of one more question on those that, you know, have a concern or don't want to get their child immunized. How do they go about doing that? What's required for them to not have their children immunized?
So this varies in every state, but in the state of Michigan for the last couple of years, they are required to go visit a health provider, often through the health department, who will talk to them about and advise them about many reasons why they should immunize their children. And once they've been informed about that, they have every right in this state to decline. But they are required to go learn about that and have someone tell them about the information, and they still get to make the decision. By the way, that since that law is passed, the number of these so-called non-medical waivers or personal exemption waivers have decreased here in Houghton and in all around the state, although maybe not as much as we hope they might, but they have decreased.
I know that Michigan at one point was not doing too well as when it ranked with other states. We've seen an improvement there as far as getting people immunized. There was a conversation I had with local health department director a couple of years ago, and we were, you know, there was a lot, big concern over the number of waivers that were given out in Houghton County for immunizations. That number is still way too high. We were looking at some of the numbers earlier, and we, you know, 83rd out of 83 counties in number of waivers issued. There's still work to be done, which is, guys, I'm glad that's why you're up here and we're doing this show too, to continue to talk about this, because yes, you have the choice, but I can't think of many other decisions a parent would make that would almost intentionally put their child in harm's way.
Yeah, you're right. There's a paradox there. I mean, my understanding from talking to many parents who felt this way, who have not wanted to immunize their children, is that I respect the parents' rights, and I respect the fact that the parents are trying to do the best thing for their children. Unfortunately, the parents have often been very poorly informed about what vaccines do and don't do, and they come to the table believing some things that aren't true. And so I do my best to try to explain to them why I think it's a good idea to immunize their children. By the way, there are a number of studies that suggest if a doctor or another health provider takes the time to carefully go over this with parents, that up to half of the time, parents will decide to change their mind and immunize their children. Now, that means half the time or more they won't, but there is an opportunity to make a difference if you spend that time educating a family and providing them information. You know, there is an alternative, and there are three states where there are no personal exemptions. I'm not sure, but I mean, the latest one is California. You may remember after the outbreak at Disneyland, the state of California passed a law that said we only allow medical exemptions now. We don't have personal or religious exemptions. Two other states already had a law like that. I think it's Mississippi and West Virginia, but I might be wrong. So there are three states where there are no personal exemptions. Now, that's pretty extreme, and I understand why many people would be unhappy with that in Michigan or anywhere else. But, you know, it may take something like that eventually to wipe out some of these infectious diseases.
How young do you need to start with your children that get them the vaccines?
So most of the childhood vaccines start at 2 months of age. There is one exception, and that's the hepatitis B vaccine. It's actually given in the nursery right after the child is born. And the reason for that is when that vaccine was first developed, it was recognized that a big problem was if the mom had hepatitis B, there was a high risk that the newborn baby could become infected at the time of birth. And so when this vaccine was first developed, it was tested right in the newborn period and given right after birth. And because it was shown to be safe and effective, we actually recommend that vaccine be given in the nursery before the baby goes home. The others start at 2 months of age. So there's sort of the primary series at 2, 4, and 6 months of age, and then vaccines given at 15 months and boosters in a few years. And, you know, very effective, wonderful vaccines, but we would love to have a better strategy so that we didn't have to have as many visits or as many injections. Every child in America would vote for more vaccines that could be given by mouth instead of as a shot. So we understand that. It's a lot of things. It's just hard. It takes a lot of time and effort to test these vaccines and get them approved. We're hoping, though, that in the future that new scientific breakthroughs will allow some of these vaccines to be combined more effectively, so that you wouldn't have to have as many visits to the doctor or as many shots, but we're not there yet.
Schools will periodically require you to have your immunization records. When does that take place?
You know, it's different in every state, and I don't know the details in Michigan, so I won't tell you, but you have to present this data when you start to public schools. Okay, so that's the main time that this the sort of main sort of checkpoints. And in order to start public schools, you've got to show that you're fully immunized or that you had a valid exemption. There can be other situations, for example, during an outbreak of measles, where a school might then require you to show specific proof about that, whatever you've done before. There might, but you, generally speaking, it's at the time of school entry that the big plus is. That's because, remember, as I said a minute ago, many of these childhood immunizations were already given at 2, 4, 6 months, 15 months, 4 or 5 years of age. So by the time a child starts school, they've had most of the required immunizations. Then there are some more that are recommended during the school years and teenage years, but the total number of those vaccines is small compared to the ones that you mainly get in infancy. And that's not an accident. I mean, the reason that most of these vaccines are given to young infants is most of these terrible diseases are more likely and more severe in young infants. So that's one reason we don't like suggestions that some people have made. Well, okay, we'll give the vaccines, but we're going to start them later or just give some of them and wait till next year. That's not a good strategy because many of these vaccines prevent diseases that are more likely to happen in the first year of life. So we need to give you the vaccine at a time when it will protect you from the disease.
If you've waited or for whatever reason your child has not been vaccinated or you know that you have never been vaccinated, is it a good idea to get those vaccines if you got older?
Yes. Some of them are no longer necessary if you're an adult, for example, because some of those diseases really don't occur much in adults. So the recommendations are a little bit different, and they are complicated, but every pediatrician, for example, in his or her office has a thick book called the Red Book. It is red on the cover, and in there are detailed recommendations for, let's say, a child moved from a country where there were no immunizations. They're 6 years old. What do we need need to give, what do we not need to give? And it's pretty clear. It's complicated. Our medical students can't possibly memorize it. You know, it's that complicated. So I don't expect parents or our physicians to know it, but it's easy to look up, and the guidelines are based on the fact that some of these diseases really only occur in young infants.
You mentioned iVaccinate.org. Is that the best place to direct people right now if they want more information about vaccinations?
I think it's a great place to go. It's brand new. I just looked at the website for the first time the day before yesterday, but it looks like a wonderful place to go. I'd also recommend healthychildren.org as another great place. But yes, it looks like a wonderful place to go. I have a laundry list of about, 15 Michigan organizations that have enthusiastically supported this effort, including the Michigan chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. So I do think it looks like a great place to have parents look at information. And a lot of the information will be Michigan-centric. So if you want to know how's my county doing or how's this area doing, you can find that information.
Dr. English, I really appreciate you coming in, and it was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.